Hello, Marco Werman here. With so much going on, it can be difficult to take a moment to pause and reflect on gratitude. We are so grateful for everyone who makes this show possible. The engineers behind the scenes, the reporters and correspondents on the ground, the editors reviewing and researching our stories, the producers making connections, finding guests, and ensuring that everything runs smoothly. And of course, you. Your support is critical. Thank you. Because of your financial support, we can run our newsroom and share with you the latest international human-centered reporting. So I'm asking for your help. From now through December 31st, we aim to raise $67,000. You can step up and donate to keep the world going strong. And to magnify the impact of your gift, a generous donor has created a match to double your contribution. If you give $100, the world will receive $200. Please head to theworld.org/give. Or visit the link in our episode notes and donate today. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks for being with the world. Now, on to the show.
Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. Wise is the best way to move and manage your money around the world, all with one account. It's for saving in dollars, pesos, baht, and more. It's for sending money back home fast and makes vacation spending in the local currency simple. You'll always get the mid-market exchange rate when you convert currencies with no markups and no hidden fees. It's one account built for your international life. Join 15 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you by downloading the app or visiting wise.com/world.
Israel's army says it's closing in on Gaza City, telling Palestinians to get out of northern Gaza. An aid worker who just managed to leave the territory tells us nowhere is truly safe.
There were still bombs. There was still constant noise. Drones overhead, constantly monitoring things. I mean, sleeping on the ground, sometimes the ground shook.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, rising anti-Semitism in Europe and how U.S. gun exports contribute to criminal activity abroad.
Guns that are legally purchased in the United States can also be hidden inside of legitimate exports like car parts, home appliances.
And getting the band back together.
We could use John and try and make a record. It was the closest we'll ever come to having him back in the room.
One final outing for the Beatles. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for making it today. Israel says its troops are now on the outskirts of Gaza City and advancing from several directions. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with combat soldiers today. Nothing will stop us, Netanyahu said. We will advance and we will win. The Israeli military said its ground forces inside Gaza killed dozens of Hamas fighters overnight. The IDF also carried out more airstrikes in the Gaza Strip today. Palestinian officials with the Hamas-run health ministry say that more than 9,000 people have been killed in the territory since October 7th. That's when Hamas attacked communities in southern Israel, killing more than 1,400 people, according to Israeli officials. Meanwhile, air raid sirens went off across Israel today. A rocket fired from southern Lebanon landed in the city of Kiryat Shmona, setting fire to a shopping center and parked cars. Soon after, Israel's military said it was responding with wide-scale airstrikes in southern Lebanon against Hezbollah. That's the powerful Lebanese militia force backed by Iran. Meantime, again today at the Rafah border crossing between southwestern Gaza and Egypt, crowds of people were trying to leave the Palestinian territory. We'll have more on that later in the show. First, we go to Europe, where the war between Hamas and Israel has sparked a disturbing rise in anti-Semitic hate crimes. In Paris, dozens of addresses were menacingly painted with Stars of David, indicating the residents have ties with the Jewish community. Across Germany, memorial stones marking the Holocaust have been vandalized with spray paint. A Holocaust memorial in Greece was defaced with the words, Jews equal Nazis. And in London, anti-Jewish incidents are also spiking. Reporter Rebecca Rossman spoke with members of the Jewish community there who say this is not the first time they've dealt with anti-Semitism, but this moment feels different.
Golders Green is the heart of London's Jewish community. 22-year-old Emmy Sinclair has lived here all her life.
This restaurant here, Florence's Pizza.
She says this kosher restaurant is a place where everyone around here gathers. Days after the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel, the restaurant's windows were shattered and its cash register stolen.
I think it freaked everyone out, I think is the best way to say it. It just felt so close to home.
Sinclair worked with the Union of Jewish Students. Her job is to make Jewish students at universities across the UK feel safe and comfortable on campus. But she admits it's something she's been struggling with herself in recent weeks. She usually wears a Star of David necklace, but for the first time in her life, she's taken it off.
Because I don't want people to know. I don't want people to be able to trace me. And I don't want... I think I'm worried about anything aggressive happening on campus.
Sinclair says some students have told her they've received death threats or been assaulted. According to London's Metropolitan Police, there were 218 hate crimes against Jewish people in the first half of October, which is an increase of 1,350%. But there were very few arrests.
I'd like to start off with a thank you. And the thank you goes to the police who are here this evening looking after us.
Gideon Falter is the head of the nonprofit Campaign Against Anti-Semitism. He spoke at a recent rally outside London police headquarters. He said police aren't doing enough to intervene.
Our Metropolitan Police looked at so many criminal offences that were taking place and told us that they were not criminal offences at all.
He singled out a pro-Palestinian march in which people were seen carrying signs he said were clear examples of anti-Semitism.
People with placards saying things like, "I fully support Hamas." Another placard with a Star of David placed in the bin. And the caption, "Keep the world clean." How did that make us feel?
Scared.
Scared, a woman shouted back. Others just shook their heads. In a press release, the police say the celebration of terrorism or death will not be tolerated at marches, though expression of support for the Palestinian people more broadly does not alone constitute a criminal offense. Standing in the crowd at the rally was Kathleen Crook, a Jewish woman from Canada who has been living in London for 15 years. She says she feels anti-Semitism in Britain has always been latent and that the Israel-Hamas war is bringing that hate up to the surface.
I think here within my friends in the Jewish community, we're all very concerned. In many instances intimidated, and I think we can't stand by and be intimidated and let it happen.
That's not to say people in the Jewish community are against the right to protest the bombardment of Gaza. David Baddiel is a prominent writer and comedian who has written a lot about modern-day anti-Semitism in the UK.
I support the right of people to protest on behalf of the Palestinians. What I do not support is the fact that there are elements of those marches, things being said in those marches, which imply that all Jews are somehow targeted.
Baddiel says the Jewish community feels neglected, not just by police, but also by progressives who have remained silent or in some cases fueled anti-Semitism.
The very people who care, the gatekeepers of morality about ethnicity and racism and discrimination, somehow or other, they don't feel that Jews are very important in that conversation, that that's because Jews are associated and the only minority that are associated with power and wealth and controlling the world and all that nonsense about Jews. And as a result, we don't get the same protections.
In the absence of those protections, the Jewish community has been coming together, says Emmy Sinclair with the Union of Jewish Students. She says synagogue attendance numbers are up for the first time since COVID, and communal Friday night Shabbat dinners are packed. Sinclair says the reaction from within the Jewish community has reminded her of a speech given by a local rabbi after his family was killed by a Palestinian gunman in the West Bank earlier this year.
And he says, we don't ask why, we ask what for. And I think it's a really powerful quote that's where can we go from here?
And that is a question that so many people here in London and around the world are asking. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in London.
Hamas is many things. The group has long functioned as an Islamic charity. It's also a political movement that obviously has a military arm with lots of weaponry and the ability to carry out suicide bombings in Israel. It's designated as a terrorist group by the U.S. and others. Hamas also has a lot of money, billions of dollars, actually. They even have a senior official in charge of the Hamas investment portfolio. That includes, for example, gleaming new apartment buildings in Turkey. Front companies, loopholes, friendly jurisdictions where money moves around freely, Hamas has found them and uses them. Wale Adeyemo is the Deputy Secretary of the United States Treasury. He spends a lot of time cracking down on illicit finance. Deputy Secretary Adeyemo, how wealthy is Hamas?
Well, you're right that Hamas has a very sophisticated financial network, which they have used to both support their fighters by weapons and also to spread their hate-filled ideology. But they have less money today than they did in the past because of the actions we've taken over the last few days and the more than 1,000 sanctions we've placed on them. I was just in Europe meeting with my European counterparts, and what we know to be true is that organizations like Hamas want to hold dollars, euros, and pounds, and that's why we're taking actions to cut off their finances.
Yeah, talk more about that trip you just completed to Europe. I'm wondering how focused it was on Hamas finances and what you were actually able to accomplish.
It was very focused on the finances for Hamas and terrorist groups like Hamas. Oftentimes, Hamas attempts to hide its finances through charities, illegitimate charities that they use to try and move money around the world that are located in countries like the United States, like the United Kingdom, like the EU. It's been critically important that the EU and the UK have joined the United States in freezing Hamas's assets and going after these illegitimate charities that they've set up. We've been working very closely with countries in the Middle East, many of which also are concerned about terrorist financing, to go after these financiers, be they in places like Qatar or in Saudi Arabia, and to cut off access for Hamas to those finances as well.
So there has been some cracking down. Let me go back and re-ask, how many billions did Hamas have prior to this tightening?
So Hamas's network of finances are hard to ascertain, but we know that they had more than enough money to conduct the attacks that they did October 7th that were heinous. But they were, for the most part, very low-cost attacks. The thing that they were able to do was to get through the fence and be able to get to Israelis using guns and knives. The missiles they have, many of which they snuck in through tunnels, were also produced with the money that they have in their savings. After their heinous attack of October 7th, Hamas went on a fundraising campaign to try and raise funds from around the world to support their hate-filled ideology. And our goal in the United States, working with our allies and partners, is to build a global coalition that will make sure that they don't have access to any of the money that they had before these attacks, and they're not able to collect additional revenue to pay their fighters and to buy more weapons to destabilize the region and attack Israel. But the key for us now is to make sure that the money that they've had access to that's outside of Gaza is cut off from them.
Prior to October 7th, would you have called those Hamas investments legitimate, or is it money laundering?
Most of Hamas's finances are illegal. They are through money laundering. And the truth is that Hamas has evolved their financing to include things like cryptocurrency and to find new ways to move money. And as they have made changes, we're changing as well. But the thing that we know is important is that while we go after Hamas's finances and their illegitimate charities, we also need to make sure that we're providing space for legitimate charities and humanitarian assistance through finances to get into the region and to get into Gaza. This is hard because in the same way that Hamas is using human shields in Gaza, they're using charitable organizations as shields for their elaborate financial networks outside of Gaza.
You mentioned crypto, Deputy Secretary. Aside from that and the luxury apartment buildings in Turkey, do you have other examples of how Hamas invests its money?
The reality is that in lots of ways, Hamas uses traditional investment vehicles to try and make money around the world. They disguise these things by using front companies and individual financiers who disguise the ultimate beneficiary of these assets. And what we've had to do is work very closely, not only with countries, but also with financial institutions, to identify the types of schemes that Hamas and their financiers are using to try and hide money. What Hamas often does is very similar to what the Kremlin does to try and move money illicitly through the financial system using front companies and facilitators. And what we've had to do is go after those networks.
So while Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey might have nice things to say about Hamas and might want to protect them, perhaps, you are able to sidestep him and work with Turkish financial institutions instead.
Turkish financial institutions want to be part of the global financial system. And as such, they have responsibilities not only in their country, but they have responsibilities as part of that global financial system to implement the rules of the road that have been established by our jurisdictions, including the sanctions that we've put in place. None of them should want to be in a position where they're helping Hamas finance the type of horrific things that happened on October 7th. And we plan to work with them to ensure that Hamas doesn't have anywhere to hide in the global financial system.
Wale Adeyemo is the Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Treasury. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Still ahead this hour, diplomats in some Latin American countries are expressing their opposition to Israel's actions in Gaza. And we speak with an American aid worker who made it out of Gaza yesterday. You're listening to The World.
I'm Darren.
And I'm Esther.
And this is Second Sunday, a podcast about Black queer folk finding, keeping, and sometimes losing faith.
This season's full of candid conversations. We're talking to theologians, artists, activists, and community members living at the intersections of faith, spirituality, and identity.
The saints ain't ready for this.
But we're still going to talk about it.
Second Sunday. Find it wherever you get podcasts.
Second Sunday is a Cube original podcast and is part of the PRX Big Questions Project.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The Israeli military campaign in the Gaza Strip has prompted diplomatic pushback in many parts of the world. Several countries in South America level criticism at Israel this week for the rising number of Palestinian civilians killed and injured. They are calling for an immediate ceasefire. One of them is even taking steps to cut off diplomatic relations with the Jewish state. The world's TV site Zaya has more on that.
On Tuesday, the government of Bolivia announced it was cutting ties with Israel.
En repudio y condena a la agresiva y desproporcionada ofensiva militar israelí.
Bolivian Foreign Minister Freddy Mamani told reporters that this was in condemnation of the aggressive and disproportionate Israel military offensive in Gaza. Hours later, the governments of Chile and Colombia recalled their ambassadors in Tel Aviv, and Brazilian officials criticized the continued airstrikes on Gaza. In response, Israel accused these leaders of aligning with terrorism. Michael Paulberg is a professor of Latin American studies at Virginia Commonwealth University.
There have been different reasons, including domestic, economic, and geopolitical, that Latin American countries have taken positions on Israel, Palestine, and the Middle East more broadly.
He says despite all these leaders being on the political left, ideology is not a definitive factor in all of the cases. Chile has the world's largest Palestinian diaspora outside of the Middle East, with close to 500,000 people.
And there is strong support for the Palestinian cause that is bipartisan and even extends to cultural areas such as sports, with Chile's famous soccer team, Club Deportivo Palestino.
Even conservative Chilean presidents have visited Palestinian territories and support Palestinian statehood. In the case of Bolivia, Paulberg says the motivation is more political. President Luis Arce, who's seeking re-election, could be aiming at voters on the left by attacking a close ally of the United States.
Arce taking a bolder stance on Israel is a play to the base of the party.
Colombia's stance is more surprising. The country doesn't have economic or geopolitical interests in the Middle East, but President Gustavo Petro has been very outspoken on the conflict. A few weeks ago, in a series of social media posts, he compared Israel's leaders to Nazis and Gaza to Auschwitz. Michael Paulberg says the statements reflect Petro's personal background.
One can only conclude that his passion for the issue comes from the heart and reflects his long career as a left-wing activist, going back to his days as a member of the M19 guerrilla movement.
The World Jewish Congress called Petro's statements an insult to the 6 million victims of the Holocaust. Maria Suarez, a young professional from Colombia, says she supports President Petro calling out Israel, but she didn't like the way he expressed it.
Creo que se equivocó totalmente.
He made a huge mistake that might backfire, she says. Manuel Mancilla, a business owner in Chile, says it's not a good idea for his country to take a stance in such a complex conflict.
Quizás lo ideal sería...
It would be ideal to keep a distance, he says. But if that's not possible, he says the Chilean government should condemn the Hamas attacks with the same emphasis. A number of Latin American citizens in Israel were killed or taken hostage in the October 7th attacks. Other countries in the region are also confronting Israel over its offensive in Gaza. Argentina, which has the largest Jewish community in Latin America, said nothing justifies the violation of international humanitarian law by Israel. Both Argentina and Mexico are calling for a two-state solution and also for the release of captives held by Hamas. For the world, I'm Tivisa Isaiah.
The U.S. Department of Commerce has suspended export licenses for guns. Like most American rules regarding firearms, there are exceptions. This is a pause in exports that will last 90 days. For many years, journalists and experts have documented how legally purchased American firearms have been used for illegal purposes. In some cases, those weapons have fueled organized crime and violence abroad. To learn more about what's going on here, we called Michael Asusa. He's a managing editor for Insight Crime, a publication and think tank. Mike, where did this policy change come from?
Well, I'd say it's not something that we were necessarily expecting, but it's also not exactly a surprise. Many countries in Latin America and the Caribbean have been calling for years for the U.S. to do more to prevent arms from making their way into the hands of criminal groups in the region. Mexico is probably the most prominent example of that. The government there sued major U.S. gun makers in 2021, basically claiming they don't do enough to stop their products from being trafficked to Mexican criminals. That lawsuit is currently on appeal. And Caribbean leaders earlier this year became increasingly vocal about this issue amid high levels of gun violence that are continuing to increase. So the Prime Minister of the Bahamas raised this issue in a meeting with Vice President Kamala Harris, and several other leaders spoke out around the same time, basically asking the U.S. to do more to prevent arms from fueling gang violence in that region.
Yeah, I mean, the Department of Commerce has not said much of anything about the suspension, no real specifics. If gun exports are suspended for 90 days, though, what does that mean exactly?
Well, the scope of the pause is fairly sweeping in the sense that it applies to most firearms, most ammunition and sighting devices as well. But there are some important carve-outs in terms of which countries it applies to. So this pause doesn't apply to exports to Mexico, for example, which is one of the countries that's been the most vocal about this issue. And then there's also carve-outs for Israel, Ukraine, most European countries, and some others. So in that sense, it's somewhat limited.
Yeah. So what do you think the Commerce Department or the Biden administration really is thinking with this move? I mean, 90 days is not long. What's the hope?
Well, I think the hope is to be seen as though the administration is doing something to respond to these concerns that partner governments have been voicing in recent years. But I think it's important to note that this only addresses legal civilian arms flows, right? This is going to have a minimal impact on arms trafficking. There's still plenty of guns in the United States, and there's many ways that they can be smuggled to the region outside of that legal export process. And I would also add that it's not entirely clear that this is going to prevent any new exports, right? This is just a pause on approving applications. So exporters can still submit requests during this time that may be approved after the pause is over, and it doesn't apply to export licenses that have already been approved. But this doesn't take any guns off the streets, right? There's already millions of U.S.-made guns floating around Latin America, and this really doesn't do anything to address that issue.
Mike, you've said that this pause in export licenses for guns will not have the impact where it's most needed. What about all of this interests you the most?
Well, I think this is an important piece of the puzzle when we're considering how to deal with organized crime in Latin America and the Caribbean. Making them harder to get is going to make it harder for criminal groups to commit the deadly violence that affects so many people across the region. But there are a lot of other factors that contribute to that violence, right? The lack of capacity of police forces, judicial systems. There's many socioeconomic issues that play into crime. A successful anti-crime policy is going to have to address not just arms trafficking, but all those various issues.
Mike Asusa is a managing editor for Insight Crime. Thank you very much, Mike, for helping us understand this new policy a little bit better.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
You're listening to The World.
Want to dive into how technology and Black spirituality intersect? Or confront the challenges new tech is creating? Maybe even catch a vision of hope for the future?
Check out Moral Repair, a Black exploration of tech. a podcast about the innovations that make our world and break our societies.
And how we can all heal just a bit. Available on Spotify, Apple, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
In Iceland, there's a large port expansion project that's got surfers very worried because this is not your average stretch of coastline.
It holds the best surfing wave in Iceland. And it's a wave that's been surfed by many of the world's best surfers.
Speaking up in Iceland to save that point break, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt this week has been the scene of intense frustration, anxiety, but also hope. Yesterday, several hundred people were allowed to get through the border and out of Gaza, all of them foreign passport holders, and among them a number of aid workers like our next guest. Barbara Zind is a retired pediatrician from Grand Junction, Colorado. She spoke with us earlier today from Cairo before a scheduled flight home to the U.S.
So it took about 12 hours to get from when we arrived at the Rafah border on the Palestinian side before we were walking to the taxi on the Egyptian side. So it was a slow process.
Dr. Zind had just arrived in Gaza to volunteer with the Palestinian Children's Relief Fund, or PCRF, when the Hamas attacks on Israel started on October 7th. That morning, she was walking with colleagues along the Mediterranean Sea.
We noticed all of these missiles coming from Gaza, Hamas missiles, and then some of them hitting the Iron Dome, but they were going in all different directions. They said, this is a lot more than normal.
Dr. Zind did not make it to the medical clinic that day. In the weeks that followed, as she told me, she and other aid workers relocated several times as the war progressed.
In all, I moved to 3 different UN centers for safety. And the first one was in Gaza City. And then we were kind of roomed with really the same group that I was with for the next 3 weeks. We stayed there for a few nights, and then we had to evacuate all of Gaza City. There was constant bombardment. I mean, the room was shaking. So we went to one first that was a vocational school, and there were thousands of people streaming in. We had one night in the floor, and then we ended up sleeping in our cars, and it was just too difficult. We went as internationals, we gather a lot of attention. So we got our own little area in a parking lot, and basically we're sleeping in the parking lot, either in the cars or on the ground on mattresses for a couple weeks. But we were lucky compared to the situation around us. There was a PCRF employee. He was with his family of 8 children, and then his extended family of 150 living next to us in the adjacent part of the facility. And,
right.
Where we had to limit water, at the end we had to restrict food. They were under those restrictions all the time. I mean, sometimes they didn't have any water. Sometimes they just didn't have water, drinkable water. They had a very meager allocation of food per day. Each person got one piece of pita bread, and then they had to split their can of meat between initially 2 people, and then it went to 4 people. So it was really bad. And that was one of the better UN places to go to because they did have some food to allocate, but a lot of them didn't even have, you were on your own for finding food and water.
It sounds like conditions around you changed really rapidly.
Right, right. Well, initially there were missiles going out, and then they became bombs and missiles coming in. Yeah, in those first few days, especially in Gaza City, but also in the south, it was always a noise. There was a plane overhead or a bombing or a missile, and there was just constant noise. When we moved to the south, people were supposed to find refuge in the south, and there was no refuge.
How did you manage your own daily needs and safety?
Right. So it was really interesting. In the beginning, we would get water filled up from a tank that's on top of the bathroom. There were about 50 people in our area, and we had one toilet. And we set up a place where you could kind of do some washing, and you could also wash yourself. And then when the water tank came, it filled up the washing water and some other jerry cans. And then we had another one for drinking water that was a large container. And we also had stockpiled a lot of water because our NGOs were purchasing it for us. So we had a lot of bottled water. We had multiple people with diarrhea. It's concerning when you're starting to have sanitation problems among people who who are, many of us are healthcare workers, and then you go out into the community and they really had no hand washing water much of the time.
Barbara, when you think about the immediate future in Gaza and how things could be changing further on the ground for the people there, what are your greatest fears?
Oh, you know, my greatest fears is just the deaths. I mean, we know that half of the population of Gaza are children, and then you add women in, and that's 60%. And when you're bombing an area, I mean, this is my probably ninth trip to Gaza, and I know these places are so, apartments and everything, people are living on top of each other all the time. And so to say, well, we're just focusing on this one Hamas person, is you just can't. There's so much collateral damage, and we know of total families that have been wiped out. I knew of one family that they helped another, one family owned some land for a farm, and this other family ran the farm. And so they took all of the people in their family, I can't remember how many it was, out to this farm for safety because it wasn't near anything. It wasn't near a site. And they were bombed and the whole family was annihilated. So, you know, you can't even hide. You can't even go to what you think is a safe place for those people.
You spent 3 weeks in Gaza during this conflict. Did you worry you would not get out?
I'm not that kind of a person. I know. You know, when I go home, I'll probably, maybe some of those thoughts will run through my head that was a possibility. But you just do what you can do. You go to the safest place you know of. You trust in people who are making those decisions to find safe places for you. And that's all you can do.
You've been doing volunteer work in Gaza for many years. As you said, this was your ninth trip. Why did you first start working there?
Well, when my youngest son went off to college, I thought, well, I should do something for my, you know, midlife crisis. And my family is from there. My father's from Lebanon, and much of his family, you know, before 1948, he was from southern Lebanon, and they would move in, you know, in and out of what is Palestine. And so many of my relatives and cousins are Palestinian. So I really related to that area. And when I saw what PCRF did, I thought it would a way I could make a difference. As a pediatrician, I don't do surgery, so I can't fix things so much, but I can try to optimize the support that PCRF does for children and what we're doing to support families. We've also been looking at hospitals and ways we can get donations to improve some of the services and some of the hospital facilities. And I love the food. I tell people that's why I go, because I just love the food. That's my comfort food.
Barbara Zind is a retired pediatrician from Grand Junction, Colorado. She's on her way home from Egypt today after spending the past few weeks stuck inside Gaza, where she had been volunteering for the PCRF, that's the Palestinian Children's Relief Fund. Barbara, thank you very much for speaking with us. All the best to you and safe travels.
Okay, thank you.
Afghanistan is a troubled nation. So much of the population lives in a state of hunger, and the country's economy is dependent on humanitarian aid, which is declining. Simply put, it is one of the poorest countries in the world. The Taliban government sees one possible solution in mining. Over the past few months, it's been signing deals with foreign companies to extract Afghanistan's minerals. It is a slow step toward re-engagement with the outside world, but as the world's Shirin Jafari reports, it's not clear whether it will provide a big boost for the Afghan economy.
The first thing you notice as you enter Afghanistan's airspace are the breathtaking mountains. They jut out of the clouds in this helicopter footage from 2019. Buried beneath these mountains are some of the largest mineral deposits in the world, worth an estimated $1 trillion, according to a paper released by the Pentagon in 2010. In August, the de facto Taliban government announced that it is now opening up these reserves to local and foreign companies for exploration and extraction. The acting Minister of Petroleum and Mines, Shahabuddin Dilawar, spoke to the press at the signing ceremony.
6,557,000,000 dollars.
He said that the Taliban have signed 7 contracts worth $6.5 billion. Chinese, Iranian, and Turkish companies can extract minerals like copper, gold, lead, zinc, and iron. Abdullah Azam, an advisor to the de facto Taliban government, wrote in an op-ed in Al Jazeera in September that these contracts will help the country tackle unemployment, underdevelopment, and currency issues. Experts are skeptical.
There's a misunderstanding often about Afghanistan and its mineral wealth. It does have a lot of minerals. They are not all accessible.
Scott Montgomery is a geologist and teaches at the University of Washington in Seattle.
I've studied a great deal about Afghanistan and its mineral wealth and also the history of exploration there, which is a very interesting story.
He says the first explorations were carried out in Afghanistan because of its reputation as a major supplier of a stone called lapis lazuli.
A semi-precious, intensely blue mineral that was often powdered and used for makeup, but also for paints.
It was also embedded in Egyptian sarcophagi, he says. Later on, the Russians did an enormous amount of geological research, he says, and did find a great deal of valuable minerals. But not much came out of it.
Largely because of the security reason, but there are also geologic reasons.
Montgomery says the headlines about trillions of dollars worth of mineral wealth in Afghanistan are exaggerated. Some of the minerals claimed to be very valuable, like lithium, are not mineable.
They're in areas where there are no roads. They're on very steep mountainsides.
Mining is complex, he adds. It takes a lot of exploration and evaluation before companies will invest long term. Mining companies don't just want to know about the presence of minerals, he says. They want to be confident about profits. Aryan Sharifi was a security advisor to the foreign minister in the Afghan government before its fall. He says he thinks there's something else going on here.
The Chinese are saying that the small deals that we are making with the Taliban right now in the mineral market is really not because we get much out of it from an economic perspective, but it's basically more or less a diplomatic chip that we're using.
A diplomatic chip, because the two countries share a border and China is worried about the threat of extremism from Afghanistan, Sharifi says. Sharifi, who now teaches international relations at Princeton University, says the Chinese are most concerned about the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, is a Muslim separatist group founded by militant Uyghurs that wants to establish an Islamic state in Xinjiang. By having a presence in Afghanistan and a relationship with the Taliban, Sharifi says, the Chinese can keep an eye on security threats. What do the Taliban get out of this? Montgomery says they gain legitimacy.
If they are making deals, especially with the Chinese, that gives them a degree of recognition that they are very desperate for.
No country has officially recognized the Taliban government since 2021, and that has severely limited foreign investments in the country. Still, Sharifi says he worries about the country's resources being misused by the Taliban. He says the mining sector is not centralized, and that means a lot of the profits end up not in the country's treasury, but in private pockets.
Much of the proceeds from the current mining is used for financing of terrorism, both inside Afghanistan and outside.
At the end of the day, he says, Afghanistan's resources belong to its people, not to a government that assumed power by force. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
File this next story under paving paradise and putting up a parking lot, except we're talking a paradise for surfers in Iceland, and the parking lot is expected to be a new port for cargo and cruise ships. Now, the words surfing in Iceland don't often occur in the same sentence, but if you're in the know, then you know, especially this time of year, in one particular spot south of the country's capital, Reykjavik. It's a break that surfer David Bustian knows well. David, tell us where you are, the name of the town, and why it's so special for surfers.
Hi, yeah. So the town is called Thorlákshöfn. It's a bit difficult to pronounce in English, but it holds the best surfing wave in Iceland. And it's a wave that's been surfed by many of the world's best surfers. And it's a wave that works quite regularly.
Yeah, and it's a point break. Explain what a point break is, because that's important in this case.
Basically, in surfing, you can either surf on a sand beach, or you can surf on a break where there's actually not sand below the water, but there's actually rocks or solid ground. And so the main difference is that when you have this solid ground, it's not going to move around with the waves. That means that when a new wave arrives towards the shore, it's going to break always at the same spot.
Yeah, kind of a rocky feature that sticks out from the shore causing that wave to break. So what's happening nearby that could threaten these perfect waves you experienced there?
So actually, I just left a town hall meeting where they approved the proposition. Basically, what they're proving is that they want to put a landfill, so they want to just extend the land exactly where the wave is. It's a good illustration of how our democracy works here in Iceland. And I know that usually people portray us as kind of a perfect country when it comes to gender equality and different rights. But the truth is that we often have issues because we elect delegates and they then take decisions on our behalf. And once we've elected them, we don't have any say in what they decide. So now, technically, they're allowed to extend land over the best wave in Iceland.
Tell us more about surfing in Iceland this time of year, David. What makes the experience so special and why surfers come from so far afield to try it out?
It's the opposite, I would think, of what it's like surfing in California or in most places in the world. It's so cold that very few people actually come here. And so that creates conditions where you have actually really good waves and very few people. And oftentimes there's no infrastructure around the wave. So you'll have, you know, a very authentic experience. You know, I think you can kind of experience what the pioneers of surfing lived when they were starting their adventure. And, you know, as we all surfers know, you know, today's reality of surfing is quite different. But we're very lucky here that we're able to hold on to that, and simply because of the extremely cold environment that we have.
Yeah, the surfing pioneers in Hawaii, though, did not have to wear wetsuits. And I imagine what you guys are putting on must be next level.
Yeah. It's about 6 millimeters. It's like half an inch, I think.
Wow.
The thickness of
Can
them.
Can you move?
We had many people come from the U.S., from many European countries, from Australia. You know, they all love it because they can really experience this kind of strong connection with nature and kind of this wild environment, which is really unique.
Are you and the other lovers of this point break in Iceland still going to kind of work to save it?
We're going to bring this case to court. We've had lawyers already looking into it for quite a while, and we're quite confident that, yeah, a very strong case. So I'm not going to say that this will be stopped, but we will take it as far as possible.
David Bustjen is an Icelander and a surfer and a card-carrying member of the Icelandic Surfers Association. He joined us from the site of this great point break. What's the name of it again, David? You pronounce it so well.
It's Thorlákshöfn. But you can say Thorló if you can.
Thorló. He joined us from Thorló. Thank you very much, David. Great to speak with you.
Thanks a lot. Likewise.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Skin bleaching is a centuries-old practice that's survived well into the present day. It's often referred to as skin lightening, and you'll find products that promise lighter skin tones in certain parts of the world, like in India. Here's an ad marketing to women there.
Yeah, lag gaya tera fem cream gold bleach.
Thanks, you're the best. Achha ek baat batao.
In Geneva, there's a meeting underway this week looking at mercury pollution and specifically the mercury present in these skin lightening products. For more, we're turning to Dr. Rupal Kundu. She's a professor of dermatology at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine and has studied the health effects of these products. She joins us from Chicago. Dr. Kundu, the meeting in Geneva looking at mercury and mercury and skin lightening products like creams, where does this practice originate from?
This practice is centuries old, and the roots are varied, but some will start in the world of British colonialism within India, for your example, that we just heard, along within Africa, along with even thinking about slavery and enslaved individuals here in the U.S.
Today, how commonly is mercury found in these skin lightening products?
So unfortunately, a lot of the skin lightening products that are available are received or retrieved from not necessarily prescription or large pharmaceutical drug stores, but instead online from community-based stores. And when we start looking into those products, a large majority can potentially have mercury well over the recommended one part per million units. There's been really great work been done by the Minnesota Department of Health, and they found that a large majority had not only mercury, but also lots of topical corticosteroids, which can also have detrimental effects. And then especially in combination, have kind of synergistic, more detrimental effects to the skin and other organ systems.
Yeah, what exactly are the detrimental effects, the negative health effects of skin lightening?
So skin lightening is complex because in general, there are some individuals that we can prescribe skin lightening creams in healthy ways. Individuals want to have even color skin. They might have hyperpigmentation from things like acne or melasma, which we can see in women during pregnancy and other hormonally induced states. And so in those settings, we can give it in a proper way. And that's what the majority of individuals use it. But when we turn to skin lightening and now thinking more broadly about generally lightening the skin, then we have to really consider the products that are in there, the ingredients. And so many might have something like hydroquinone, which again can be used safely under kind of the discretion of a medical professional and with some guidance, but over long-term use can have untoward effects. You can get permanent hyperpigmentation called exogenous erythrosis. You can get unnecessary lightening of the skin, of like peripheral skin as well. And there have been reports of more acute systemic effects to the respiratory system and the renal system, which is the case of mercury. Also within even leading to anxiety and depression, and those have also been reported.
Wow. Beyond the health effects, doctor, of the chemicals, what is the cultural critique of skin lightening products?
Yeah, this is something of major conversation because there are obviously psychological and emotional effects to individuals that perceive that having lighter skin is a positive attribute and might lead to finding more life partners, having more social status, getting a job, and then also having negative self-esteem. And there have been some studies that were done actually within Africa that also showed that have other negative, like physiological effects, higher blood pressure, for example, in individuals that might kind of perceive that have darker skin and that lighter skin is a positive attribute to hold. So it's medical, but it's also very psychological and very cultural, and it has kind of been multimodal impact on our patients.
Is skin lightening changing in popularity? Is it growing or decreasing?
So it really varies across the globe, and you can see, and it varies based on studies as well. But if you look at a meta-analysis that was done in 2018, it really did show that there continues to be a major persistence, I would say, in skin lightening. In that meta-analysis that had about 68 different studies and nearly 70,000 different participants, it showed about 28% of individuals had tried to bleach their skin. So it's 1 in 4 worldwide. It's a very large number.
What about societal pressure not to lighten one's skin? Like, is there a cohort of people on the side of be proud of who you are and what you look like that can turn the tide?
Yes. And I think that's where our research and kind of our thoughts have come. We want everyone to be proud of the skin they're in and have healthy skin. And there are a lot of movements within the scientific community that can kind of contribute. And then also within legislation. So how can we really thinking about protecting our population from these ingredients, right, that are in these cosmeceuticals that are accessible, that is over $30 billion industry of skin bleaching. So just being really mindful of the access and thinking about, again, why. So I feel there's just a lot of different things, the kind of historical concepts of it, what we feel it might impose in our daily life, the accessibility to the products, and then obviously the secondary health effects in so many different ways.
Dr. Rubal Kundu is a professor of dermatology at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. She joined us from Chicago. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
It started out as a little demo cassette recording.
I know it's true.
John Lennon recorded this in his New York City apartment more than 40 years ago.
It's all because of you.
And now the song is being released as the Beatles' final single. It's Now and Then.
And now and then.
The song is something of a recording trick, of course. John Lennon on lead vocals is no longer alive. George Harrison was still alive, though, in 1994 when the remaining Beatles began discussing whether or not to work up Lennon's unfinished song. In a behind-the-scenes video made for the release of Now and Then, Paul McCartney says he imagined a conversation with John, asking him if it was a good idea, and he knew Lennon, with his love of experimentation, would have approved. In that same video, Ringo Starr summed up the feelings of the Fab Three.
We could use John and try and make a record. It was the closest we'll ever come to having him back in the room.
Back in the room for one more spin. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll be back with you again tomorrow. Marco here. Before we go, just a reminder that right now the World is holding our fall fundraising drive. Your support is critical. It powers our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting. Our goal is to raise $67,000 before the end of the year. Every gift counts. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and donate. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much and be well.